to Speak for Yourself from the Crib, presented by Hyundai. Happy Monday, Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley, to start your week off with some awesome sports talk. We have a great show planned for you today. All right, stick around. We have the most fearless discussion of the day. Deshaun Watson dragged into a bit of controversy as people relived the draft where Mitchell Trubisky was the top quarterback taken while the Bears passed on Deshaun Watson and Patrick Mahomes. We'll get into that controversy. Deshaun Watson may have stepped on his own toes, but I'm not sure. All right, but first, we're going to talk about Michael Jordan and Last Dance. And we'll go out to the Bay Area and bring in our Fox Sports NBA analyst, Rick Bucher, who obviously covered most, if not all, of Michael Jordan's career. Guys, let's go right here. Last Dance last night, episode 7 and 8, brought into clear focus just how maniacal Michael Jordan was, I think that's the word I wanted to use, in his pursuit of championships. Michael Jordan, a bully, intimidating his teammates. We heard Bill Whittington, Will Perdue, Steve Kerr, Judd Bushler, B.J. Armstrong talk about Michael Jordan being a jerk and being relentless. We heard Scotty Burrell. We heard trash talk from Jordan, where he was pretty relentless in his bullying tactics with his own teammates. I'm watching this last night, and my initial gut reaction as I watch is like, Michael Jordan is the Bobby Knight of basketball players. Michael Jordan has a lot in common with Bobby Knight, the legendary Indiana coach known for his temper, known for his bullying tactics with his own college players. That was my thought last night. This morning, a friend of mine that I went to Ball State with, he was on the basketball team. He's originally from Detroit. He texted me a message that was even better than my Bobby Knight analogy. He asked the question, so as a Pistons fan, I'm watching Michael Jordan be celebrated as this great leader for bullying and intimidating his teammates, but I'm looking at Isaiah Thomas be vilified for bullying and intimidating his opponents. And Isaiah Thomas is vilified. Michael Jordan is celebrated. There is some hypocrisy here. And I want to be clear here before I toss it to Marcellus and Rick. Obviously, I've made no secret of the fact that I'm friends with Isaiah. I'm a fan of Isaiah. If you study my journalistic career, I have defended Isaiah Thomas through thick and thin, through all the controversy. I think Isaiah is one of the most misunderstood athletes of my lifetime and my generation. I love Isaiah Thomas. Having said that, I have a lot of respect for Michael Jordan. And last night, when I was watching it, made the Bob Knight analogy, I was someone that really never had a problem with Bob Knight and his tactics. I certainly never had a problem with the Pistons and Isaiah Thomas and their tactics. But I do think it's hypocritical the way Michael Jordan is celebrated as this great leader, and we're all kind of laughing and looking back and like, oh, my God, it was very effective what Michael Jordan did. He celebrated. Meanwhile, Bobby Knight, Isaiah Thomas vilified. And so which leaves the question, Bobby Knight, Isaiah Thomas, their legacies have been diminished because their tactics allegedly went over the top. Marcellus, get us rolling here. Should Jordan's bullying tactics diminish his legacy?
No, they shouldn't. And I think we're being a little excessive when we're saying the word bullying based on what I saw in episodes 7 and 8 last night. That was not bullying in my experience. Think about it. Like, even the situation when you were talking about Steve Kerr. I went to Steve Kerr, who was going back and forth with Michael Jordan, in their words. Finally, Jordan gave a foul that left no doubt that that was a foul. And Steve Kerr punched him in the chest. Now, when you're the smaller of the two, but you're an adult, guess what? It comes with a consequence. It comes with a price. Michael Jordan just fired back with an eye shot. Better landing spot, probably more visible. He wins the fight. But He was defending himself. Like, Steve Kerr actually hit him first. Now, this is my greater point. In all of the folklore of Michael Jordan and the legend of this maniacal serial assassin and this mentality that no holds barred, that's the greatest example we have of Michael Jordan and how killer he was in terms of being a teammate and his killer instinct. Like, I know this was a Disney production because it's on ESPN, ABC, but I need more. I need something felonious because my D-line coach on a Wednesday in the preseason showed me and gave me more hell than what I saw last night in that documentary. So I chalk this up to guys who really can't say they're bullied. They're sitting there in Jordan brand clothes. He's apologizing and calling them after the so-called bullying. What kind of bullying is this? I think some of this is being lost in exaggeration.
Yeah, no, I do not have a problem with Jordan's approach because there was a purpose behind the punishment. I don't know if you guys ever saw the movie Whiplash with J.K. Simmons as this sadistic musical director, but he was able to get the best. He would drive and get the best out of his students, but he did it with these mental tricks and this abuse that was clearly over the top. What told me about where Jordan's mindset was is the fact in the Steve Kerr incident, he realized that he'd gone too far. He measured, what do I have to do to get these guys ready to perform under the pressure of the playoffs? Well, you know what? In practice every day, I'm going to put them under my pressure and see how they react. He knew instantly that punching Steve Kerr probably was going a step too far and said as much, which is why he called Steve. But everything else that he did, there was a purpose behind it, which is I need to get you ready to be in the cauldron with me in order to win it all. And look, the ends don't always justify the means, but in this case, they clearly did, because not only did he deliver with championships every single time, but as you heard players talk about it, they were grateful for the experience. Did I like it in the moment? Hell no. Did you get me where I wanted to go? Yes. And Jordan made it clear. He was going to find out, why are you here? Are you here because it makes you a lot of money? Is it here because of the fame? Is it here because you just like to play basketball? Or are you here to win it all? And if you were there to win it all, you were willing to stand up to it, as BJ Armstrong alluded to. And if you weren't, you're probably calling your agent and say, you know what, I need to get someplace else where I can make money and just play basketball.
I hate to go here because I think y'all going to pounce and it's going to be hard for me to recover from the way y'all about to pounce on me. But everything y'all are saying,
we're not going to bully you, Jason.
People would justify Bobby Knight's actions. But Bobby Knight, the same thing. People that went through that military-like experience with Bobby Knight on the other side would say it was awful, but man, did we win? Did I learn things? And look, I'm very consistent. I'm from Indiana. I got the whole Bobby Knight experience. If you went there, you signed up for that abuse, and he delivered. I had no problem with it. Have always defended Bobby Knight, even when he's crossed the lines or whatever and he's been wrong. But overall, defended Bobby Knight. All I'm saying is Isaiah Thomas, the Pistons, the bad boy Pistons, they bullied Michael Jordan. They bullied their opponents. Michael Jordan still holding a grudge. Isaiah, reputation, never given the credit that he fully deserves as one of, as, in my view, the greatest leader the NBA seen other than Bill Russell, in my opinion. He and Bill Russell on the same level. To take his undersized body and do what he did in the NBA with his group of teammates. He didn't play with the top 50 players, Scottie Pippen, Magic playing with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Larry Bird playing with Kevin McHale and Robert Parrish. Isaiah took his group and won championships and was a force in the 1980s, beat Bird, Magic, and Michael in the 80s. Somehow his reputation as a leader is diminished. But Michael Jordan, and again, y'all saying that, look, not only beating up Steve Kerr and he knew he was wrong, the bullying of Scott Burrell, Horace Grant, don't feed him on an airplane. We've heard story after story. I'm not trying to diminish Michael. I watch it and I love it all. I love all three of them equally. This is what winners do. But to me, it's hypocritical. Isaiah, Bobby Knight get trashed. Michael Jordan gets celebrated.
Yeah. Hey, I'm with you right there, Jason, talking about the likability and how that comes into play. And it's invincible. You really don't understand how much of it is coming into play in your equation of what you desire and what you don't. Think about it. Like, there are so many ways and so many styles of leadership. You just brought up Isaiah Thomas. And look, if Isaiah Thomas had a nice shoe and a sweatshirt like this, maybe we would talk about him in greater terms. But the fact of the matter is, this helps whatever else Michael Jordan wanted us to subscribe to. If you think about it, Magic Johnson was a tremendous leader. Tim Duncan, a tremendous leader. All did it differently. So this whole best way of leadership is really just the best way that they tried, and we just have to live with those results. But other people have been as successful in their own right doing it a different way. So what I think I want to minimize is this whole legend of Jordan as the killer teammate. I think he had a killer mentality, a winner's mentality, and he did it with a frown most of the time. But guess what? That was just his way to grand and all of a sudden make this bigger than it is I think where we do Michael Jordan and leadership a disservice. What I witnessed in this documentary the most is the fact that when you're the man, everything is better because you're the man. And when you're not, when you're Scott Burrell, you can say the funniest joke in the world. It ain't that funny because you ain't that good. When you're Michael Jordan, it's the bullying is the power of who you are, not necessarily what you're doing. It's just the fact that Michael Jordan walks in a room and people are at ease. So that's what happens in this situation. I'm gonna minimize the power of what came out of his mouth and his actions, but also emphasize more the power of him, the man.
This is the distinction that I make between Isaiah, Bobby Knight, and Michael Jordan. For me, I had no problem with any of their tactics. Although Jordan did, as he demonstrated, he knew where the line was and he knew when he went over it. I don't have any issue with how Isaiah approached things, but stick by it. Jordan made no apologies for the way that he approached things. He said, "This is why I did it. This is why I was. This is what I was after. And ultimately, I'm not going to take any of it back." I feel at times as if Isaiah has tried to explain why he was doing what he was doing. You don't need to explain anything to me. If you were successful, then that's explanation enough. And Bobby at times did go too far, but would never acknowledge that he went too far. And I find it interesting that Isaiah actually played for Bobby Knight at one point, that there's a connection there. Mm. So the other part of this is, and I think for the general public, you're dealing with athletes, professional athletes, all who've had tremendous success. You know this, Marcellus. You know this, Jason. You need to have the biggest ego in the room in order to convince them to stay in line and follow a certain path. Scottie Pippen went off the reservation when Michael Jordan wasn't there. That's not by accident. I dare say he wouldn't have done that if Michael Jordan was still on the team. And the fact that Scottie Pippen said, "I'd do it again if I had it to do it all over again," tells you just how massive that ego is and how hard it is to put guys in line when they're all professional athletes. Michael Jordan understood that and did what was necessary to make it happen.
Let's end on this note. I want to comment from each of you on this. And this is my problem. And I got my Michael Jordan cigar. I still support Michael, but there's some hypocrisy here. Michael Jordan, to me, owes Isaiah Thomas an apology. I'm telling you, I watched this, thought of Bobby Knight. My friend made me think about the Isaiah Thomas connection. And I'm watching this. I'm going, this man is sitting on TV talking about, "I hate Isaiah Thomas. Basically, I have no respect for what they did, the Pistons and their approach and blah, blah, blah." And I'm like, Isaiah bullied opponents. You bullied your teammates. But you still, 30 years later, have a problem with Isaiah Thomas. You ran him off the damn dream team. Because allegedly, he was, you know, a bad guy. Nobody, he was going to mess up chemistry and blah, blah, blah. And maybe Mike wasn't alone. But to me, Mike looks hypocritical, still holding a grudge against Isaiah Thomas. Can we at least agree on that?
Yeah, I agree with you right there, because Isaiah looks the most authentic of them all, being the leader of the Bad Boys Pistons. He's like, this isn't for show. I'm going to do this in my life, in my heart, inside and out. Whereas I think Michael Jordan's became more of a persona, more of a pick and choose when you can show that killer mentality. But then in situations where someone actually is exemplifying that, like Isaiah Thomas is, you don't respect it. I thought game recognized game. If you really a killer at heart like Isaiah is, the undersized man, the little engine that could, then you should respect Isaiah instead of always picking at Isaiah. So because he has more rings, he'll win that conversation. But in my eyes, Isaiah looks like the more authentic one.
Yeah, I don't know if it's hypocritical. I feel as if Michael is still angry over the fact that Isaiah never bent the knee. Isaiah never fully acknowledged that, yeah, you got the best of me. The way we heard Magic say it, the way we heard Bird say it. Because if Michael truly understood what happened, he would appreciate that Isaiah did to him what Michael Jordan did to his teammates, which is he forced him to reach a level that maybe he would not have been able to reach on his own. But because of the way the Pistons beat the snot out of him and the way they physically abused him and the way they suffered no quarter from him, they forced him to change his game. They forced him to get into the weight room. They forced him to accept the triangle, and they ultimately made him the player that he is today. I can see where you'd say it's hypocritical in that he's not appreciating that Michael Jordan is not the player he is today without Isaiah Thomas and the Pistons.
Yeah, I don't need to add anything to that. Let's get out of here. We'll come back. Same guy, Rick Bugle. We'll stay in the Bay Area. We'll talk a little bit more about Michael Jordan and the Last Dance documentary. Michael and the documentary addressing the gambling issues, the death of his father last night. You'll hear our reaction to that. Speak for yourself from the crib, presented by Hyundai. More after this. Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the crib. Happy Monday. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley. Speak for Yourself presented to you by Hyundai. All right, let's rejoin with Rick Bucher from the Bay Area and continue our discussion about the Last Dance documentary and Michael Jordan. Another compelling part of last night's episodes, they covered the rumors and the speculation and the reports about Michael Jordan's exit from basketball in 1993. His first retirement, people speculated it was due to his gambling and that he was secretly suspended by David Stern. David Stern and everybody involved in here categorically denied it during the documentary. And they also covered the death of Michael Jordan's father. He was murdered in 1993. There were rumors and speculation that Michael's gambling played a role in his father's murder. Michael denied this very clearly, and to me, I think very authentically, I think it was irresponsible for those of us in the media, anybody that gave any of that any credence as it relates to Jordan's father. And having watched this documentary, it really brought into focus, he just had won his third title. He had been telling people that he was thinking about retiring, and then his father dies during the summer of 1993. The retirement makes perfect sense. I just don't think it has anything to do with gambling. What did you guys think of the way the docuseries handled the gambling conspiracies around Michael Jordan?
I loved how they handled it. They showed both sides of the coin. They showed you Jordan's truth, his perspective, what he saw, what he went through, and his reality, his emotion. But they also addressed the conspiracy theories. The elephant in the room, they didn't hide from it. They actually tackled that head on. And we all can sit here and say there are three sides to every story. But in that sense, because they cover both sides, they really squeezed us to a place where you have to believe them because they came off as authentic and they tried to address it from all angles. So I truly respect that. a grander point that came from this also was the fact that a lot of times we attribute what we think of someone onto who they are versus what they're really going through. And it's just funny to watch that song and dance, because everyone always, when you bring up Jordan in the barbershop, 6 championships, no game sevens, the best to ever do it, eclipsed Magic Johnson's 5. And then you start to realize Jordan didn't care after 3. Like, Jordan was just like, as long as I got 3 in a row, I was good. And it's just amazing how we can give legs to anything, as we were giving legs to the conspiracy theory back then about his father and his gambling. So it's just good to see him strip away all in his reality and show you his naked truth. I loved how they covered it.
I appreciate that they addressed it, but I'm going back to earlier in this series when the gambling first came up and we were promised that it was going to be addressed. And yes, I agree with you, Jason. Irresponsible for anybody just to float those rumors or try to make that connection without having enough evidence to do so. But this felt like a great opportunity just to bash the media for making that connection. And we fly right by the whole gambling issue. That still hasn't been addressed, because one of the reasons that it came up was because there was so much evidence that Michael did a lot of gambling for what the average person would consider was a lot of money. And whether he had a problem or he didn't have a problem, or whether it interfered in any way, that never is truly addressed. I would love to hear from Michael what it was about gambling. He played for the highest stakes in his game, and obviously he loved adding some juice to it in everything he did. What was it about that satisfied him? So I would love to hear that aspect of it. And if he had addressed that, then I feel like I can move on. But this felt to me like a great opportunity to, how dare you connect my father's death to my gambling? The media is terrible for doing that. And granted, was. But it now leaves open, okay, so what was it about the gambling? How bad was it? What was it that appealed to you? That still has never been addressed. And it leaves a hole in this whole narrative for me.
Rick, I hate to go here, but I got to go here with a slight joke here, and I apologize up front. I'm going to address it more seriously, but I've spent 75% of my money on gambling, booze, and women, and I've wasted the rest of it. So I just want to say the mystery of gambling isn't that hard to figure out, man. It's one of the funnest things you can do. But I'll say this on a more serious note. As it relates to his dad, I just think any discussion of Michael's gambling playing a role in his dad is so unbelievably unfair. Mm. And this is where I would criticize the doc while defending the documentary. I think Michael Jordan, because the only thing I was disappointed with was that we didn't really get the raw emotion of Michael talking about his relationship with his father. They showed the video of Michael on the ground crying after winning a championship and just sobbing, unbelievable. But we don't have anything of Michael today reflecting on that and really deeply reflecting on his father. And the reason why I don't think we have that, and I think people are going to say, well, man, that sounds silly. But I really think the Michael Jordan crying meme over social media has made Michael be like, I'm not going to give you that kind of emotion in this documentary and have anyone take any of it and make it a joke over social media. Me crying authentically about my father. And so that's my only really question about the documentary, is I wanted to see Michael today more reflective, more open about how tight he and his dad were and that relationship. But I just think he feels like he's been treated so unfairly by the media about his dad's death. Could you imagine? Your dad is murdered, and people are without any evidence speculating that you had some role in that, I would be angry, bitter, and be like, you know what? I can't share any of this with anybody because it could be used against me. That would be my disappointment. If we wanted to have a discussion about Michael and gambling and was he Pete Rose? Did it affect him on the court? Blah, blah, that's one thing. And maybe it would have been nice for the documentary to cover that. But I can't really criticize the documentary, man. It's been the greatest thing we've had during this pandemic. Marcellus, have you got any final thoughts or additional thoughts?
Yeah, it's interesting you came to that place. You talk about that you wanted him to go deeper, be even more naked about his emotion and his connection to his father. I thought he did a great job of that. And I don't think they stopped short because of the Jordan meme. He survived the Jordan meme almost to the point where it introduced him to other people outside of his audience and humanized him. He even made mention in light of it at Kobe's wake. So I think that he's fine with the meme in terms of showing his emotion and would have went there again if it was necessary. But I really want to talk to the great point of he knows that people blame him for his father's death without any really great merit, great evidence. They just go there. And him, with all the power of approving what goes in his doc, circle that conversation. That's amazing. Your dad's gone. They blame you. And you say, you know what? I'm still going to address what you are trying to blame me of that has no merit. So this situation to me, I think they really attacked it head on with really no stops in place. Just let's address it. Let's get out of the way. Of course, there's always going to be another example of what we want to see. But I think they did a great job at addressing all of it.
Yeah, let me be clear. It's outrageous that anybody made that connection and completely unfair. And how he handled that is actually admirable. That because I can't even imagine how I would have. All that said, the pictures said everything for me. I don't know that I needed him to say more. The glimpses of him when you knew the backstory and you see the look on his face as he's playing for that first championship after his father's death on Father's Day said more than anything he could have said to me. The one missing element that I'm interested in, and it's been missing throughout this documentary, is when I think of my dad, I think of being a dad. And my tribute to him in many ways is trying to be the father to my son and daughter that my father was to me. And we get none of that from Michael, who is a father, and how his relationship with his dad and losing his dad informed or impacted his relationship with his kids. And I dare say fame and his pursuit of excellence probably was a factor in it. But I can't help but think and wonder, like, what about that relationship in light of this other one?
Well, I think you raise an interesting point. I'm sorry we got to end on this note. We got to move on to LeVar and talk some NFL. But Rick, I'll just say it again. The media, in any way speculating about his dad's death, in Mike's mind, that's been so unfair, he's unwilling to go there in any substantive, reflective way. And I think that even relates to his own kids. It's just like a closed shop. You can't handle it. And what I'm saying, and I think what you're saying, is that it would be fascinating to hear the most famous athlete in the world talk about his relationship with his own kids. We got LeBron James and dealing with his kids. We got LaVar Ball and dealing with his kids. It would be fascinating to hear from Mike. I just think Mike's in a position where he just doesn't trust the media enough that if he goes there, will we be fair? Will we extrapolate things? And he and his family are dealing with some unfairness that he's just not willing to take that risk. Yeah. All right, we got to keep it moving. We're going to talk about Deshaun Watson and the Bears' decision to skip over him. Deshaun says the Bears never talked to him. That's what he said over Twitter today. A few years ago, he said the Bears did talk to him. We'll get to the bottom of it with LeVar Arrington. Speak for yourself from the Crib, presented by Hyundai. More after this. Well, I'm about to speak for yourself from the crib, presented by Hyundai, Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley. Happy Monday. All right, let's roll out to LeVar Arrington's crib and talk some NFL. Let's talk some Deshaun Watson. Dragged into a bit of controversy by noted author, friend of mine, John Feinstein. John played the race card on the Chicago Bears, saying that they, you know, it was racism why they overlooked Deshaun Watson and Patrick Mahomes and instead drafted Mitchell Trubisky. Doug Gottlieb went at John Feinstein. And the next thing you know, Deshaun Watson joined the parade, tweeting out, "The Bears never once talked to me." He retweeted Gottlieb's tweet and then said, "The Bears never once talked to me." Well, now we've discovered that back during the draft time, Deshaun said the Bears did talk to him. There was one of the teams that had shown a lot of interest in him. And there were reports at that time that during the combine they talked to him and had an interview, there were reports. Anyway, the question is this a bad look? Has Deshaun Watson been caught fudging the truth?
It is a bad look, and maybe not for the most obvious reason. Like, I think there are two questions posed that we're trying to figure out. Is this a football lie, or did he get caught up in the clout chasing algorithm, which is basically the hottest topic, usually with an ism, racism or something like that, or somebody who has a big name, you attach to it, you jump on that wave, and oh, you got caught out there in this situation. I think in this situation, he looks bad because he told a football lie. Now, what's happening right now in real time is the fact that he's trying to protect those, including himself, who have benefited from this same football lie. So in full disclosure, I talked to his agent this morning, David Mulugeta. Hopefully I'm saying his last name right. But we talked about this situation, and what he remembers is what Deshaun remembers, that they didn't talk to the Chicago Bears explicitly. But what's happening with a lot of the top picks, and LeVar should certainly speak to this more so than even myself, is that they get into that strategy of marketing and making themselves sound more attractive to the teams around there. So there are players that I've heard that say, the teams that are drafted in front of me, I'm going to say I'm talking to those teams so that I could create some kind of noise around my name and hopefully I benefit. So I think right now what you're seeing is the conflict of him trying to tell his truth over actually violating the code of which these top draft prospects go out there and try to sell.
You know, what's interesting is it's a code that he's trying not to violate, but I'm going to put it in plain terms for all of us to understand. We've been in school before, all right? There was a dance. You asked this person to the dance. You asked that person to the dance. For some reason, you didn't get picked by that person to go to the dance. You wanted to go to the dance with them, but you ended up going to the dance with this person, right? So all these years later, no, it's not a bad look on Deshaun. You know what? You want to know what it is? Is that he's standing there with the person that chose to go to the dance with him. I'm not going to look at the person I'm at the dance with and look at the person that didn't take me to the dance, didn't choose me to go to the dance, and be like, oh, yeah, they was hollering at me. They wanted to go to the dance. We were supposed to go together, but something came up, so I ended up going with this other person, right? Nah. True to the game, Deshaun Watson is in this situation by not sitting there dragging somebody who didn't want to go to the dance with him into the conversation.
Well, I'm going to make a journalism analogy. I asked every newspaper in the country to take me to the dance. Every news begged. And there were some that ridiculed me in terms, and I'm talking about in 1990, 1991, 92, 93, 94, begged. Someone at the Washington Post in like 1993, 94, how dare you even apply? Wrote me a letter. Basically, how dare you even apply for a job here? You're not remotely qualified. I had someone, I was a black woman, by the way. I had someone at the Indianapolis Star, my hometown paper, white guy, wrote me back a letter mocking me for applying for a job at the Indianapolis Star. I could roll over, oh my God, I'm a victim. It was racism and blah, blah, blah. Instead, it wasn't nothing but fuel for me. And so I look back, and for a long time, I carried that letter from the Washington Post. I carried the letter from the Indianapolis Star. And when I started putting in work and making all of them look like clowns, it didn't do anything but make me feel better. In the NFL, they make mistakes at quarterback, offensive tackle, right guard, left guard, defensive end. The draft is an inexact science. Jamarcus Russell went number one overall. It was a stupid decision by the Oakland Raiders. It wasn't fueled by racism. The Bears made a dumb decision. Somebody fell in love with Mitchell Trubisky. Deshaun, don't in any way feed into you're some sort of victim. Go put that work in and put clown suits on everybody that passed over you in the draft. Let that be fuel for you rather than you want anybody to feel sympathetic or vilify the people in Chicago that just made a dumb decision. We all make dumb decisions. I'm sitting here thinking about all the dumb decisions I made. My best friend talked me up out of the best relationship I ever had. It was one of the dumbest decisions of my life, and it was no substance to it at all. The decision. It was all about the size of the rear end. I'm not joking. And people do dumb things. The Bears did something dumb.
Yeah, I mean, I think why I say he looks bad is because what he took on as bait actually became bigger than he expected. Whether he took the race baiting of this conversation and said something that towards he was a victim in this situation, basically saying they never talked to me, which was the truth, which I believe it was the truth. Like, why lie about it now? You can go out to get a contract extension from Houston. He says that. And then he's like, all right, here come the receipts. And now he's like, oh, now if I really double down on the truth, I'm going to violate the code, which affects more than just me. So let me just jump on this grenade. I think that's how we got to this place. When you're talking about your example, Jason, you're right. Like, no matter what you're thinking about, the greatest revenge is success. So I don't care what color, what complexion, what flavor it is. You go out there and win. We've all been there. LeVar's example, a lot of people turned me down for the dance. A lot of girls until I got drafted. And then I was turning them down for the dance because the tables done flipped, you know. Now, how does it feel when the rabbit got the gun, basically? So we all know that. So Deshaun hopefully can protect his name and protect others, which is going to be difficult to do in this situation.
Again, I think I think he showed levels to it. He took a shot at Chicago. Like, they didn't talk to me, meaning that look at the career I'm having right now. I think the only reason why I could be considered a bad look off of what you guys are giving as reasoning, which is sound to me, is that he even responded in the first place. But if you were going to respond because they're talking about you and putting you in a tweet and we're in a pandemic and you had a little bit of time on your hands, you know what? I ended up getting picked to go to the dance with a better looking chick than the one that passed up on me. So you know what? You never said anything to me. I don't know anything about it. I feel like that's his approach.
All right, we got to go. We'll be right back. We're going to talk some Patrick Mahomes. Would the Chiefs be making a mistake if they paid Mahomes $50 million? That's what Chris Collinsworth says he's worth. Speak for yourself from the crib presented by Hyundai. More after this. Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the crib. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley, happy Monday. All right, we'll be rejoined again by LeVar Arrington from his crib. All right, let's move to my favorite quarterback, Patrick Mahomes, quarterback of the Kansas City Chiefs, Super Bowl champion, MVP of the Super Bowl. Chris Collinsworth of NBC says that he would be really surprised if the Chiefs don't pay Patrick Mahomes $50 million a year. Marcellus, would it be smart for Kansas City to pay Mahomes $50 million a year?
I would say yes, obviously factoring in the increase in the salary cap, and obviously because of the coronavirus and the pandemic, there's expectations that the cap will go down $30 to $80 million next year. If that's a projection that comes true, then it's going to be tough for him to get that. But if the cap continues to go up as it does every year, 10 plus million, yeah, because you still have him under contract, and we're not talking about today. We're talking about the next deal, which could be a couple of years away. So, yes, you're talking about the youngest guy to ever win a Super Bowl and an NFL MVP. in league history. So when you're good in this league and you're trending great, Jimmy G, Russell Wilson, et cetera, all those kind of guys, whatever you want to say, Matthew Stafford, you get paid. When you're already great and you're trending all-time great, Mount Rushmore status, trust me, you're going to get paid and it's going to be enormous.
Yeah, I agree. I think it would be smart, but you got to do it now. You know, when you pay that type of money, you mentioned the salary cap, you're not going to be able to afford a whole lot of the dudes that you have on the team that make him better as well as a player. So it's smart. And to this point, you got to add into this conversation. It doesn't seem like Dak Prescott is outwardly overly egregious and wanting $40 million if where we're heading is $50 million on the next go around of people getting these types of contracts. So I think it's an interesting move in the sense that if they get this deal done with Mahomes and it's that high, then now you've put every single organization and every single agent and quarterback out there, high market class, on notice that here's where we're going. And I don't have to be better than Patrick Mahomes. I'm going to get this money. And that, I mean, it's smart for Kansas City to do it because you're out ahead of it with one of the greats. But, man, it's going to put a lot of teams in bad situations because it's going to be some not so great quarterbacks trying to come for $50 million a year.
I don't think it would be smart. And I say that as someone that thinks Patrick Mahomes is the best player in the NFL, the next iteration of John Elway, going to be great for 15, 20 years over the course of his career. But it's been proven. If you take up that high of a percentage of the cap, your teams don't win Super Bowls. The smart play for the Chiefs is to try to get him to buy into a long-term vision of let's win a bunch of multiple Super Bowls. Let's make you in the conversation for the greatest quarterback of all time. And there's money to be made with winning and that level of success, multiple MVPs. And so you got to have Tyreek Hill. You got to have Travis Kelce. You got to have a good offensive line. You got to have some defensive players. I just don't think it would be smart for Patrick Mahomes to take $50 million a year. And particularly, I think what Marcellus is saying about the impact of the coronavirus and what it may do to the salary cap, I think it makes it even less likely that the Chiefs are inclined to go that route. And I hope that Patrick Mahomes is reasonable, that making $30, $35 million a year at that position and winning, that's the best long-term play for him over the course of his career.
Let's be real, though. Look at the Super Bowl again, and don't forget, the team that spent the most money was playing against the team that spent the least amount of money. So there's a way up that mountain, even if you're spending more than the Chiefs. And the Chiefs were the ones spending the least amount. So there's a way to cook those books and figure it out if you want to. And he certainly is the player that I will want to do it around because he deserves it.
And to your point, LeVar, I think this coronavirus and the salary cap may actually blow up in Dak Prescott's face. He may be, if the salary cap goes down, he may be getting offered a lot less money. All right, stick around. Uncle Jimmy's around the corner. We'll have an approval rating for the GOAT of basketball, Michael Jordan. Speak for yourself from the crib. More after this. Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the crib. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley. Time to roll out to Uncle Jimmy's crib. Uncle Jimmy, welcome into the show. Do you have a big dummy of the day?
Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah. Big dummy of the day goes to the person that said that they spent 75% of their life earnings on booze, gambling, and women, and you wasted the rest. You got that tomorrow. It's the other way around, ain't it? Huh? Look here, man.
No, let's it ain't.
No, it's really not.
Yeah, it's about right, man. It's a low number. Look, man, let me tell you something. You do
you
know
any thoughts on Michael Jordan?
Yeah, but you do know that people say that you're a bully too, right? Okay? But I'm going to tell people from firsthand experience, y'all absolutely right. Okay? But let me tell you something, nephew. If it wasn't for your bullying and your totalitarian terrain and demean, Uncle Jimmy wouldn't be where he's at today. See, I could be back at home with my loved ones, safe and secure, broke with my pride and dignity intact. But instead, you brought me out to Los Angeles, put me on a TV show just to embarrass me at the final 47 minutes of your show. but I don't complain, do I? I take it like a man. That's what you're supposed to do. Thank you, nephew, for bullying. I appreciate it. I owe you for bullying me, nephew. Thank you.
Pass the ball, Jimmy Burrell. Open.